You're tuned to Radio Ace from Imaginary Stations, where radio connects us all.
Ring, ring, telephone ring, somebody said, baby, won't you do it? I've been wondering where you've been.
Man, I'm looking for a song I heard today. There was someone blue singing about someone who went away. Just like me, his heart was yearning for a love that used to be. It's a lonely song about a lonely man like me. There was something about a love that didn't treat him right, and he'd wake from trouble sleep and cry her name at night. Mr. Record Man, oh, get this record for me, won't you please? It's a lonely song about a lonely man like me. I was driving down the highway with the radio turned on, and the man that I heard singing sounded so blue and all alone. As I listened to his lonely song, I wondered, could it be? Could there somewhere be another lonely man like me? There was something about a love that didn't treat him right, and he'd wake from troubled sleep and cry her name at night. Mr. Record Man, oh, get this record for me, won't you please? It's a lonely song about a lonely man like me.
Set your receivers, set your receivers, set your receivers.
Set your receivers for a mesmerizing story found at the intricate intersection of technology and creativity.
Explore the path of this circuit diagram that connects telegraphy and the invention of the telephone with radio laboratories and the advent of our global communication systems.
At the heart of this narrative is the evolution of speech synthesis in the quest to make a machine
capable of speech.
This groundbreaking innovation not only revolutionized telecommunications, but gave birth to a new era of electronic music.
Tracing the origins of synthetic speech and its applications in various fields, the Radiophonics Laboratory unveils the pivotal role it played in shaping the creative vision of sound pioneers and maverick musicians.
This is the story of how electronic music started with the dits and dahs of Morse code
and transformed into the blips and bleeps that have captured the imagination of musicians and dedicated listeners around the world.
Pick up your copy of the Radiophonics Laboratory today.
Available from velocitypress.uk, bookshop.org, and fine bookstores everywhere.
You're listening to something different for your airwaves. Imaginary Stations.
Back now with Day to Day. There are treasure hunters for all sorts of things, especially old vinyl records. Dori Hadar is one of them. On weekends, he scours secondhand stores and junk markets. On one expedition, he happened on a treasure trove of albums by a guy named Mingering Mike. He's a soul superstar of the 60s and 70s who's released over 50 records in just 10 years. Never heard of him? Neither had Dori. Until that day, our tech contributor, Jenny Jardin, has more.
Dori Hadar works as a criminal investigator in Washington, D.C. by day. He's a DJ and vinyl collecting crate digger nights and weekends. He remembers the morning he stumbled into the biggest mystery he'd ever encountered, flipping through record crates fresh off the truck at a local flea market.
I thought they were real when I first started pulling them out, but it quickly became clear as I opened them and realized that they were handmade. They contained actual cardboard records, circular pieces of cardboard painted to look like records, but they were definitely not real records. I really was dumbfounded. I had absolutely no idea what these things were, but I knew I had to have them.
He bought what he could and rushed off to work. Later, he scanned some of the hand-drawn album covers to share with fellow vinyl junkies on a soul record internet forum called Soulstrut. "Can Mingering Mike Stevens really sing?" read one album title. There was an imaginary sickle cell anemia benefit record and soundtracks for made-up movies like You Only Know What They Tell You and a Bruce Lee-style funk action concept album, Brother of the Dragon. On another, the track list reads, "She's Not a One-Guy Girl," then "Come On Back," followed by "Frustrations of an Angry Young Man." "I'm very concerned with the growing rates of suicide, threats, killings, alcoholism, addicts, prostitutes, fakes, frauds," Mike writes in one fantasy liner note, "and the success of this album."
Everyone on the forum just had to know more. But when you listen to the recordings and you hear his voice and the passion, you know, as he sings, I mean, you can really picture him just sort of isolated in his own fantasy, and it just adds another dimension to the whole thing. And he just instantaneously had a huge fan base. All of a sudden, Mingering Mike was a star.
Word spread fast throughout the internet. Millions wanted to see these fantasy album covers for themselves, but all of a sudden, the images vanished. Dori explains.
It became more and more clear how personal these things were. They really are like diaries. And, you know, the more I thought about it and the more attention it started receiving, I realized, hey, how would I like it if someone posted my diary on the web for a million people to see? And so I actually took the pictures down at one point so that I could try to find him first and make sure, you know, that this was all okay with him.
Who was Mangering Mike? Was he still alive? Had he thrown this stuff away? Was it stolen from him? Dory wasn't the only one obsessed. It was like the whole internet wanted to know, too. At the urging of emailers, Dory, now remember, his day job is criminal investigator, tracked him down.
At first, I went to an address in Maryland. Mike actually lives in D.C., and I spoke to a cousin there who turned out to be one of Mike's fictional musical artists named Audio Andre. And I knocked on his door and I asked him if he knew who Mingering Mike was, and he just started laughing hysterically.
Dory had more detective work to do before he would finally find the imaginary soul superstar. For NPR News, I'm Shenny Jardin.
Tune in tomorrow for part two of The Mystery of Mingering Mike, and go to NPR.org to see the album covers and hear some more of his music.
You're tuned to Radio Ace from Imaginary Stations.
On the tiny blue transistor radio.
He bought it for my birthday just one short year ago. This tiny blue transistor radio. We stayed up late. Tiny blue transistor radio. And the man at the radio station made a special dedication to Jimmy and the girl that he loved so. We kissed each other gently as we listened so intently.
No, only half when it's raining. Once again, to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
From Fair Oaks, California, gateway to Sacramento, Tate Bloom writes, Dear Dr. Science, why does my cassette player eat my tapes? What could I feed it as a substitute?
Your cassette player is hungry. So many people have this problem because they never bothered to read the instruction manual that came with their tape player when they bought it. You may recall some mention of head cleaning solution. Well, this is just another term for tape player food. If you don't feed the heads, they'll eat your tape. It's that simple. The food they like best is 90% rubbing alcohol. The normal 70% solution you buy at the neighborhood drugstore just won't cut the mustard. You'll end up with a rusty-headed, hungry tape player that'll still eat your tapes. Hope I've answered your question.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Imaginary Stations wants to hear from you because radio connects us all. Do you have a phone with a microphone? Send us an audio postcard from wherever you are in the world. Send us greetings from outside the train station in Paris, or your favorite songbird from Germany. Send your audio to imaginarystations@gmail.com, and you may hear yourself in an upcoming broadcast.
in a flying saucer, flew down to Earth one day. Looked to left and right of it, couldn't stand the sight of it, and said, "Let's fly away." They took a look at a Western movie, somebody heard them say, "If a horse can be a star, think how dumb the people are, we'd better fly away." Then they shook their little green antennas, scratched their purple hair, said, "This planet is an awful menace, let's go back to where we came from." Two little men in a flying saucer just didn't care to stay.
No, no.
Said it's too peculiar here, headed for the stratosphere, and quickly flew away.
Now they took a look in Ebbets Field in Brooklyn when the Dodgers played a baseball game. Heard all the screaming, said we must be dreaming, 'cause this planet is insane.
During their mission, heard a politician making speeches as they traveled by.
Gabble, gabble, gabble. But they departed faster than they started, 'cause the hot air blew them sky high.
Two little men in a flying saucer flew down to Earth one day. Listened to a radio, saw a television show, and said, "Let's fly away." They got their fill of commercial jingles, and they were heard to say, "All the people seem to be living in a nursery, we'd better fly away." Traveled all around, and once they'd seen us, said, "Let's head for space. We were better off on Mars and Venus.
Goodness, what a place to live in."
Two little men in a flying saucer just didn't care to stay.
No, no.
Crossed a crowded thoroughfare,
saw the hats the women wear,
and quickly flew away. One look and then they flew away.
A man in a flying saucer. A man in a flying saucer. A man in
a... Shaking like a leaf on the desert heat. Steady's got a bug in his heartbeat.
The artist who goes by the name Mingreen Mike grew up in a tough part of Washington, D.C., just a few miles from the Smithsonian American Art Museum. His family did not spend much time there. Mike was entirely self-taught as an artist, and now his work is in that museum permanently, NPR's Joel Rose reports.
There might not be a Mingreen Mike story if it wasn't for Dori Hadar. Hadar is an obsessive record collector. One morning in 2003, he showed up early at a flea market in Washington, D.C., and started digging through crates of used LPs.
Clearly, it was someone's personal collection, and there was all kinds of great stuff in there. And then I came upon this one crate that contained albums like I had never seen before. There were approximately 40 LPs that had hand-painted covers and handwritten liner notes and lyrics. And they were all made by someone named Mingreen Mike.
At a glance, the albums look like other soul records of the 1960s and 70s, except they're obviously drawn by hand in colored pen and pencil. They feature a young black man with an afro and sideburns, sometimes alone, sometimes with other musicians and dancers. The titles seem to trace the arc of a real career, grooving with Mike, Boogie Down at the White House, and the Mingreen Mike Show live from the Howard Theater. Hadar pulled out the LPs to check their condition.
And they weren't in very good condition at all because they were made out of cardboard. And someone had painted them with a shiny black paint so that they looked real.
Hadar didn't know why anyone would go to these lengths to create an imaginary musical career, but he wanted to find out. It happens that Hadar is a private investigator by trade, and a couple of weeks later, he and a friend were knocking on a door in Southeast D.C.
And the door sort of cracked open, and this guy peered out at us. We said, "Mingreen Mike?" And he didn't say anything. And we told him, you know, "We found some of your things at the flea market." He said, "My babies?"
Mingreen Mike was glad to know his albums were safe, but initially he was not happy to see Dori Hadar at his front door.
"Extortioners coming in the ghetto and saying, 'I have your stuff.' What would you think?"
As a young man, Mike was a loner. At first, he didn't want anyone to see the album covers he made either.
"I thought a lot of it, but it was just something private I did. That's the only way I could say things at the time, because I was an introvert."
He poured his energy into making album covers and songs of his own. Starting in the late 60s, he recorded hundreds of songs on a reel-to-reel recorder with his cousin.
"The best studio would be the bathroom with the acoustics and echoes and things like that, and that's where we did most of our stuff. It was just like the human beatbox would do.
I wish I could say what's on my mind." Mike says the album covers seemed like a natural way to archive his songs, just in case a real record label ever came calling.
"I was basically building a repertoire of things just in case something like that happened. The dream was always there."
At first, Mike's songs were mostly about love and heartbreak. But his concerns started to change around 1970, when Mike was drafted into the military. He made it through basic training, but when it was time to fly to the West Coast and probably on to Vietnam, Mike just went home.
This piece is The Two Sides of Mingreen Mike, and Mike actually calls this probably his most important album.
Leslie Umberger curated the exhibition Mingreen Mike's Supersonic Greatest Hits at the Smithsonian American Art Museum, which acquired Mike's collection 2 years ago. We're standing in front of an album cover Mike made shortly after going AWOL.
He went home and he made this piece, and it kind of shows himself as the civilian on one side, you know, back to back with himself as a soldier. And on the back side, it shows the singer and the artist making people happy, and the other Mike, the soldier, going to war and standing in formation.
As a deserter, Mike was afraid of getting caught, so he stayed inside a lot. This turned out to be a very prolific period for Mingreen Mike. Some of Mike's recordings are also part of the collection that was acquired by the Smithsonian, thanks in part to gallery owner George Hemphill. He was the first to show Mike's work and still represents him. Hemphill says this is an important folk art collection.
"It tells a story.
There's so much buried history about Washington within each album, and all together it creates almost a time capsule view of a particular kind of musical consciousness and cultural community.
Mingering Mike's artistic career wound down after President Carter pardoned the Vietnam draft dodgers in 1977. Mike got a job and put his hand-painted albums in a storage unit. Eventually, he fell behind on the payments. That's how his albums ended up at the flea market. Since being rediscovered, he's made a few public appearances as Mingering Mike, but always in costume. He accepted an award from the D.C. City Council dressed as Spider-Man. At a panel discussion about his work at the Smithsonian, Mike showed up dressed in surgical scrubs and mask and made the following offer.
After the interview, to the left, I would be performing colonoscopies.
Kidding aside, Mike says he's glad to see his babies on display in one of the nation's premier museums.
I'm one of the people that's up there. Not too many people get that opportunity while they're still alive.
Mingering Mike has finally found an audience, even if it's not the one he imagined. Joel Rose, NPR News.
Sunshine, baby, whenever you smile, but I call you stormy today. All of a sudden, that old rain's falling down, and my world is cloudy and gray.
This is Radio Ace from Imaginary Stations. Email us at imaginarystations@gmail.com.
Good Norwegian wood.
We return to the mystery of Mingering Mike. While rummaging through record bins at a flea market, a vintage vinyl collector named Dori Hadar found what looked, at first, like a vast trove of recordings by an R&B great from the late 60s and early 70s. But a closer look revealed that the whole thing was fake. Inside these elaborately illustrated covers were just cardboard discs with hand-drawn grooves. Dory shared the cover art with fellow record collectors online. The fictitious soul superstar Mingering Mike became internet famous, and so Dory made it his mission to track this mysterious artist down. We left off in part one of this story, where Dory tracks down one of Mike's cousins.
I knocked on his door and I asked him if he knew who Mingering Mike was, and he just started laughing hysterically.
Now, Day-to-Day's tech correspondent Jenny Jardin returns with the rest of the story.
Vinyl collector Dory Hadar works as a criminal investigator by day, and he used those skills to keep trying to locate whoever was behind all those obsessively crafted cardboard fantasy records.
So I left a note, but I never heard from anyone.
Then the message got through.
I called the relatives, and they just happened to say that someone came and left their phone number. So after a couple of days' delay or something, then I called.
Finally, a breakthrough.
This guy peeked out from his door, very suspiciously.
Well, he and Frank had came to the door, and he said, I have some items that belong to you. I said, my babies? You have my babies?
The man known as Mingering Mike says he lost all those pretend LPs, 45s, the lyric sheets, because he'd fallen behind on rent at a storage space where they were kept. They ended up at the flea market where Dory bought them.
He thought they were gone forever, so he was really happy that they were still around.
But all of that added up to only a fourth of the work he'd produced, and some of it's still missing. What Dory did find were meticulously illustrated album covers with crazy, funky themes and hand-lettered liner notes, pretend shrink wrap around the covers, saran wrap, and scotch tape. There were songs with titles like Underwear Drying at My Front Door, I'd Like to Teach the World to Eat Like Me, and Sometimes I Get So Hungry I Can Eat a Light Bulb, or a Chair, or Even My Hair.
I used to think of titles all the time, and it just gradually started coming in a little clear. You know, it's like a fog, that like you're going through a fog and all of a sudden you see sunshine. You know, it was just a creative time.
Mike's brothers, sisters, and cousins figured into the fantasy. That cousin whose doorstep Dory showed up on, the guy who laughed hysterically, Audio Andre. Just one member of this legendary soul superstar family. Mike and his siblings did record some songs on reel-to-reel tape, sometimes tapping out percussion with an afro pick struck against a mattress or a phone book. Around the time real-world soul superstars were taking off in the late 1960s, Mingering Mike was launching his imaginary career on record companies he'd made up. Minger Records, Sex Records, Nation's Capital Records. This was the heyday of the album, according to historian Gerald Early at Washington University in St. Louis.
Records were interesting artifacts to people. I mean, the labels themselves on records were just often very interesting pieces of graphic art. Mingering Mike, what he's doing is sort of echoing or mimicking this transformation that's taken place and how the public sees the music and albums as a creative act.
On many of Mike's cardboard records, the credits say, written, produced, arranged, performed, accompanied by Mingering Mike. It was as if he was emulating multi-talented musicians of the time who wrote, produced, and performed their music, like James Brown and Curtis Mayfield. Gerald Early.
Mayfield and Brown were two of the really leading figures of the period who were leading this transformation of black music into this kind of album-oriented music.
If you scan through Mike's album covers, you notice they change as the years pass. Themes like the Vietnam War, drug abuse, kung fu movies crop up, and imaginary live performances at venues like D.C.'s Howard Theater, one of many real places in African-American neighborhoods where touring soul greats would play live, theaters that would begin closing in years to follow.
So he's kind of capturing with this album art what you would say is sort of a world that's entering its twilight phase at the time he's doing it, between 68 and 76.
Suddenly, another part of the real world intruded.
I received that letter that everyone received back in the 70s about greetings. This is Uncle Sam, and being inducted into the armed forces. And, you know, there's no way out of that.
The career of the imaginary soul superstar was cut short at its peak.
So the night before, I just put my feelings into music and words, and I just did that a cappella right at the spur of the moment. But all I can do is cry.
Mike went AWOL and went into hiding. He resurfaced later after the government offered draft evaders an amnesty program.
Did community service, and after that, just got a regular job.
So who is the real Mingering Mike now? He doesn't want to be identified because he fears losing his job and his privacy. But people still want to know more about him. Music journalist Neil Strauss remembers when he and the rest of the world discovered Mingering Mike.
I think of all the stories I wrote in the New York Times, I do think it was the one that kind of got the most response after I wrote it. Like, gallery owners called, people wanted to make documentary films called.
And now, Mike has a book out produced with Dori Hadar, Mingering Mike, The Amazing Career of an Imaginary Soul Superstar. A gallery in Washington, D.C. will open an exhibition of his album covers this June. Mike and Dori are also producing a real vinyl 45 version of one of those cardboard 45s.
It's like a long dream that you've been having so constantly, and then all of a sudden you forget about it, then all of a sudden, you know, years later, it returns and it's reality. And it's rather shocking, surprising, amazing. Everything wrapped up into one.
Coming to you from our newly retrovated shortwave transmission facilities, somewhere along the 45th parallel. It's something different for your airwaves. Imaginary stations, where radio connects us all. Hey, this is DJ Frederick, the shy, reluctant announcer. I hope you've been enjoying Radio Ace from Imaginary Stations. We love to communicate with you, so you can email us at imaginarystations@gmail.com. That's imaginarystations@gmail.com. On behalf of One Deck Pete and Justin Patrick Moore, thank you for listening and wishing you many blessings.